So, you've had a hard day. Work was hectic, the traffic was a nightmare, and your kids are screaming at the top of their lungs about how it's unfair that they need to go to bed, despite the fact it's 45 minutes past their bedtime. But all that's behind you now. It's time to unwind. Those blissful few minutes between the completion of all your cleaning, organizing, and preparing for the following day, and bedtime. You sit down, pour yourself a tall glass of your favorite adult beverage, search through the podcast app of your choice and download the latest episode of your favorite show hosted by a brother and sister team originally hailing from the island of Newfoundland. And then you see it. Scurrying across the floor is a bug. Maybe it's an ant. Maybe a carpenter. Or a pill bug for you non-Newfoundlanders. Or heaven forbid, a cockroach. You lift your foot high in the air and with the crushing force you stomp the bug and exclaim, "Not in my house." But when you pick up your foot, you notice something infuriating. That bug, the one that you almost put your foot through the floor to eliminate, scurries off even faster than before, completely unharmed. So you step on him again, and again, and again. Finally, after 7 to 10 attempts, you hear the crunch, see the ooze, and take satisfaction knowing that you have killed one of God's creatures. On tonight's episode of the podcast, we're not going to talk about bugs, but we will discuss some humans who, despite several attempts to have them stomped out, scurried away only to keep on living. These stories, like that analogy, are guaranteed to be some weird.
This is the most violent opening I think I've ever heard. And I love the reference of the carpenter, but here we go. Welcome to the Some Weird Podcast, a podcast about strange and unusual stories told by us, a sister and brother team hailing from the carpenter capital of the world, the island of Newfoundland. I'm your co-host, Chrissy.
And I'm your co-host, Barry. And when I lived in Ontario and I saw one of those bugs and I called it a carpenter, someone looked at me like, "What are you talking about?
Is it building a house?"
Yeah, I was like, that's what they're called. I didn't even know they're called anything else.
But carpenters.
Yeah. Yeah, but they might be called pill bug, sow bug, roly poly. There's lots of different names, but carpenter is the name here in Newfoundland.
Yep.
In this episode, we're exploring the extremes that a human body can withstand, but with a morbid twist.
No talk about amazing feats or Guinness Book of World Records here.
This one is about people who are almost unkillable. So let's get it on the go.
Let's.
I'm going to tell you a story here about, is it Rasputin or Rasputin? As Boney M. destroyed the actual pronunciation of this man's name.
I think they stretched it out to say Rasputin to make it rhyme with their song. I think it's Rasputin.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought so too. Have you ever been to a wedding at the local Legion? The snooker table is tarped off, and that's a reference that maybe one person will get.
I get it.
To anybody who doesn't know, there's a in the Bay Robbers Legion, they have a snooker table. It's the only Legion I've ever been at that has a snooker table.
It's the only snooker table I've ever seen in my life, I think.
Yeah, and they have a tarp on it, but when you want to go play it, you go play. Dad and I used to play all the time.
Yep.
Anyway, you're at the wedding, you're at the Legion, you're having a drink, listening to the standard wedding music fare. So, what are some of the songs you hear at a wedding, normally? What do you think?
Like a Newfoundland wedding?
Yeah, Newfoundland wedding, any wedding, I guess.
You're going to hear "I Knew the Bride When She Used to Rock
a Oh, Bone." Yeah, I got that one on the list, yeah.
You're going to hear probably like "Girls Just Want to Have Fun."
Yeah, I don't have that one, but that's a good one.
You're probably going to hear "Friends in Low Places."
Yeah, that's good.
Let's see. Oh, "Electric Slide."
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I don't have that on the list, but yeah, that's definitely one there.
Yeah.
"The Bird Dance" is going to be going there. Na 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 na.
Yep. Wedding music is terrible. In fact, when I got married, I gave the DJ a list of songs that he was not allowed to play. And I believe those were all
on
there.
All those were on the list, yeah.
Yes.
A couple I got here is "Gray Foggy Day," the old Newfoundland two-step.
What's a Gray Foggy Day? I probably know it, but I don't know the name of it.
Yeah, you'd know it if you heard it.
Okay.
"I Knew the Bride When She Used to Rock and Roll," like you said. And that's when the bride gets out there, everyone gets around the circle, everyone takes a turn having a little dance with the bride.
It's terrible.
Like a bunch of tools.
Like a bunch of fucking skeets.
Yeah. "The Authority" song by John Mellencamp's a big one.
Okay.
And "Home for a Rest" from Spirit of the West is another very popular one around here anyway.
Yeah, you wouldn't hear that down this way.
These are all great songs, but the one song that when you hear it...
No, they're all terrible songs. Come on.
Okay.
Rewrite that.
All right. They're all shit songs, but there's one song that you hear at many weddings, and when you hear it, the hands start clapping. The "hey, hey, hey" chants get going. You look for your friend, parent, aunt or uncle, grandparent, spouse, or whoever, and get on a dance floor because it's... "Ra, ra, Rasputin, lover of the Russian queen."
I was just going along with it.
The classic Boney M. jam. I seen Bo Diem live very recently, and of course they broke this one out. Third encore. I didn't think they were going to do it.
I wish that was true.
But it is a very crowd-pleasing song. It has good beat.
Yeah. You could pretend you're one of those Russian dancers kicking your leg out.
Oh, yeah. You sit down low and you start kicking your feet out.
Someone throws out their back. It's not a wedding till the ambulance comes.
That's right. Like I said, good song. I've never really listened to the lyrics of it before. Again, I'm not sure how accurate it is historically, but it does tell the story of one Grigori, and that's probably pronounced incorrectly, Rasputin or Rasputin. But anyway, here's his story, and I'm going to focus on his unkillability. So Rasputin was born a peasant in the area around Siberia in July 21st, 1869. Very little is known about his early life, but historians agree that he grew up uneducated and illiterate. And again, he was a peasant in the old feudal system of Russia, and that's not uncommon.
That tracks.
There's some records that show he was a bit of a hard case, a skeet, if you will. There's records of theft, drinking, and other small crimes are rumored. But again, it's unclear actually what he did or didn't do. His parents had seven other kids, but none of other ones except for him lived to adulthood. So right off the bat, there's his first unkillable attribute.
Holy shit, he sucked the life out of all of them, probably.
That's right. When he was 17, he met a peasant girl named Kraskova Dobrovina. They had a short courtship, and they were married. And they ended up having seven children. Only three made it to adulthood. So I guess that was common for the peasants' kids. I guess a lot of them didn't live.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say 19th century Russian peasants were not in the best of health and didn't have access to the health care and nutrition, especially out in Siberia.
Yeah, it wasn't universal health care out there. You can whip down to the health science, to the emergency room. Sometime in 1897, Rasputin found religion and decided to make a holy pilgrimage. His reasons kind of remain unclear. Some say he had a vision of the Virgin Mary. Others say he was wanted for horse stealing. Either way, he did do this holy pilgrimage. He disowned his own life, including the six kids he had at the time and another on the way for religious reasons, which I think there's a bit of irony in that.
Yes.
He swore off alcohol, became like a disheveled later year beetle. long hair and all that kind of stuff. He prayed, sang more than usual, and he became a holy wanderer, going from town to town, spreading the good word. What kind of life is that?
We gotta start making a list of these ridiculous jobs. Yeah. Holy wanderer, professional skeptic, ocean fart studier.
When I heard that holy wanderer, first thing I was thinking was when Jules in Pulp Fiction, what he said he was going to do?
A walk to earth.
That's right. Like solve Cain. Problems. That's right. So anyway, he's going around town to town, spreading the good word, and he started to get a small following. Word began to spread of his teachings. In 1904, he traveled to the city of Kazan. Although there was rumors that he was having sex with all his female followers, he made a favorable impression with the religious leaders there, and he continued to make contacts and friendships in that world. These contacts eventually included the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II. So the royal family became enamored with Rasputin and convinced he was a faith healer. And they could heal their son, Alexei, from hemophilia.
Wasn't there a TV commercial on back in the 80s about hemophilia? It's not really a common disease.
Probably.
Oh my God, it was a commercial. It was a little kid. It looked like he had two black eyes.
I don't remember that.
It scared me when I was a kid. It was like super creepy. I'm putting you right off your story.
Oh, that's right.
Hang on 1 second. Jeepers Creepers. Where'd you get those peepers?
Yeah, I remember that. That was about hemophilia?
I think so.
Jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those peepers?
But I can fly. Creepers, where'd you get those peepers? I got hit from inside by hemophilia.
On the Wi-Fi, that's so funny.
It's creepy. It's scary. I got hit from the inside. I'm like, I'm just picturing
from
like,
the hemophilia.
That was a digression. It's like a horror movie. Anyway.
So again, it was unknown when or why the royal family came to believe that Rasputin could heal their son of hemophilia. But it could have been from an incident in 1906. Rasputin was summoned to pray for Alexei when he discovered he had an internal hemorrhage. And he recovered the following day. So the only possible explanation was Rasputin's prayer saved the young boy from bleeding out internally. So there's a few other occurrences where Rasputin's prayers helped cure Alexei's bleeding. And this caused many to believe in his status as a faith healer. You know, if he's healing the czar's son, then he must be a real holy man.
And the thing, too, about it was the czar and czarina, they had four kids. Three of them were girls and only had one boy. And the way that the Russian line was, only the male could inherit, right?
And that's the way it is for a lot of, well, I guess not in the British, though, is it? The
not in born, British, no.
But that's common, I guess, for the male, which, you know, kind of dumb when you think about it.
But that's why it was so important for somebody to make sure that Jeepers Creepers didn't die, because
that's right.
That would be the end of the line.
That's it. So again, the royal family became very close to Rasputin due to his ability to heal Alexei, and he had their trust. And unfortunately, this is probably not a good thing, as he used his trust to gain advantage. His stories began to circulate that Rasputin was having sexual affairs, some consensual, some not consensual, with members of the royal family. I don't want to dive too much into this other than to say that it certainly appears that he had inappropriate relations with several young girls in the royal family.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I guess the Russian queen, too?
According to the Boney M. song, yeah.
Yeah. Despite this, and again, I'm not sure if anything was ever proven, but he remained close friend and confidant to the family right up to his death. But, you know, his sexual encounters were certainly well known, so it's certainly not out of his character to do something like that, right? He started to become a bit of a controversial figure. On the religious side, stories of him having sex with his followers, some consensual, some not consensual, made him less popular in that religious world. And then on the political side, people began to think that he was getting too much power to his relationship to the Tsar.
Yeah.
External factors such as World War I, the end of feudalism, and the rapid decline in Russia's economy, they started blaming him for it and his relationship to the royals. So, because of that, he started accumulating enemies, and enemies wanted him dead. The first attempt on his life happened on July 12, 1914. A woman by the name of, and again, I apologize for pronunciation, Chernoya Gazeva, attempted to stab him outside his home. He was seriously wounded, but he did survive the attempt. It was said that this wound did bother him right up until he actually died.
So, who was she?
Why did she do it?
Yeah, what was her stake in it?
She was a follower of another religious figure, a guy by the name of Lidor.
Oh, okay.
This person was a follower of Rasputin originally, but denounced him his ways due to his sexual exploits.
Got it. Okay, so she wasn't doing it because she thought he was getting too much power.
No.
She was just against him for...
Because she was following some other dude who wanted him dead.
She sounded like she was a religious fanatic and went from one crazy monk to another.
Exactly.
Okay.
This Lidor guy was a part of a group that wanted to drive a wedge between Rasputin and the royal family.
Okay.
The woman, when she was arrested for the attempted assassination, was said she acted alone, but police believed she acted on Lindor's behalf. There was no evidence to support this, despite the CSI's attempt to find hair follicles or semen stains. And all kinds of camera angles from the point of view of the rocks on the ground and things.
Of the semen.
A second attempt on Rasputin's life happened on December 30th, 1916. A man by the name of Felix Yusupov led a group of nobles who decided that Rasputin's influence on the royal family was too great and threatened the empire, so he needed to be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
This group included Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich and politician Vladimir Persevich. Solid Russian names, right?
These sounds like fake people, but at least you could pronounce those.
That's right. They're like the Joe Smiths of Russia. So, one time in late December, Rasputin was invited to Yasparov's palace for a party. Little is known what actually happened that night, but its most widely accepted version came from excerpts from Yusupov's diary. Now, whether or not this was his fictional account of what happened or whatever, but this is the generally accepted idea of what happened.
Okay.
So, Rasputin arrived. He was taken to a wine cellar. There was party music upstairs with the illusion that there's a big party going on, a dance maybe, gray foggy day perhaps, with tarped off snooker table. So while they're in the cellar, Rasputin was fed cake and wine. The cake was laced with potassium cyanide and said to have enough to slay an army. Initially, Rasputin refused the cake, but after a slight convincing, he ate one. To Yasupov's surprise, he seemed no worse for wear after having the cake. Instead, he asked for a glass of wine to wash down his tasty cake.
Another Pulp Fiction, it sounds like.
Exactly. A Sprite. Ooh, a big kahuna burger. Anyway, the conspirators figured, okay, the cake didn't get you, but the wine will. So they had the wine laced with the same cyanide poison. So what normally happens when somebody ingests this poison, they fall unconscious within seconds.
Okay.
But Rasputin was sitting there drinking the wine like he's a connoisseur, spinning it around.
Smelling it. Talking about bouquets and under smells or whatever they talk about.
Hints of oak and cyanide, he said. After finishing the first glass, he looked at him and said, "Please, sir, could I have some more?" So he got a refill of the poison wine, and after the second glass, he began to have some difficulty swallowing. They figured, oh, I got you now, you bastard.
Yeah, you fucking carpenter.
Yeah, sorry. So he looked up at him and said, my head's a little heavy, and I have a burning sensation in my stomach. Can I please have another glass? So he said, okay. Another glass of poison. That third glass seemed to straighten him right out.
What?
Rasputin said, let's go party so I can find a drag off.
You're saying all the words here tonight. Well, you got to explain what a drag off is then.
The university that Chrissy and I went to was Memorial University of Newfoundland. It was a very popular university bar called the Breezeway. So the term drag off would be you go to the Breezeway, you'd hook up with a person and you bring them home with you.
That's a really terrible term.
It's a very bad reference. As I speak to you, I said, that sounds terrible, but it's all consensual.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, so Rasputin goes up to get his drag off. Before he goes upstairs, Yasupov excused himself and he said, I got to go upstairs for a second. I'll grab something, then we'll go to the party. So he met with Dmitri and he grabbed a revolver from him. So he went back downstairs, looked at Rasputin, pointed at the crucifix on the wall and said, you better look at that crucifix and say a prayer, and shot him in the chest.
Whoa.
So Rasputin fell to the ground. The conspirators grabbed Rasputin's coat and went to his apartment to make it look like he went home for the night. So they kind of dressed up to make it look like him, and they made it look like Rasputin leaving the house for the night.
Like a weekend at Bernie's?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So he had pulley ropes on his arm, so when someone said hi, they kind of did the wave thing.
Okay.
So they did that. They returned, and he go back to the basement to dispose of Rasputin's body. When he went to grab him, he opened his eyes, leaped up, and attacked Yusupov.
Oh, my God.
There was an enormous struggle, and finally the prince, Yasupov, freed himself and ran upstairs. Rasputin followed him, and he ran into the courtyard where Dmitri shot Rasputin two more times. He collapsed in a snowbank and finally died. They wrapped him up and threw him in a river.
Did he actually die then?
Yeah, yes, that was the end of him.
Oh, okay.
So the question has to be asked, how did he survive so much poisoning? There's a few theories.
Can I give my theory before you get into real ones?
Sure, go ahead.
I think that they were just very bad at making and mixing poison.
Yeah, that's one of the theories. Shitty assassins.
Yeah.
They weren't given enough poison, or it was old and decayed, and it was something far less toxic. There's another theory that he may have been aware of the upcoming assassination attempt and took some sort of antidote as protection. He might have conditioned himself by taking very small amounts of poison over time to develop immunity.
Iocaine powder? Like Princess Bride?
It's like he vaccinated himself.
So he had good points. He wasn't all bad.
There was a theory that he had alcoholic gastritis, which led to him having less stomach acid. And the stomach acid is required to have a chemical reaction with the cyanide to make it toxic. So physiologically, poison wouldn't bother him.
Okay.
Another theory is the sugar had a counterbalance effect on the cyanide. So the cake may have helped balance out the toxicity.
Did he put a layer of bread before he went to the Breezeway?
So he put a base in there.
You know what a bread base is, right?
Oh, yeah. Soak up the booze. You can drink more. But anyway, the cake may have helped balance out the toxic elements of the poison. Because I can't say toxicity very well.
Just said it, though.
Yeah, that's right. I said it really good, but I didn't try to. And probably the most likely thing that happened is that the guy made the whole thing up. He was simply shot when he arrived, and the rest of the story was made up because he wanted a brother and sister team from the island of Newfoundland to tell a story on a medium that wouldn't be invented for another 80 to 90 years.
Nice. Maybe that's what I'm going with. We do have listeners in Russia, so maybe he had foresight. Oh, yeah.
There we go. And that's the story of the remarkable unkillability of one Rasputin, immortalized by Boney M.
If it wasn't for the Boney M song, would as many people know about Rasputin?
Probably not. That was a pretty big hit. And like the whole story about him getting poisoned and all that, it's all in the song.
Yeah, he seemed like a real dick.
Yeah, he wasn't, from the sound of it, he wasn't very nice. I mean, you look at the story, he left his wife and seven kids, just took off and started, you know, being a holy wanderer.
Yeah.
Lots of stories of him taking advantage of his followers and having sex with them.
Yeah, he's like a Charles Manson kind of a guy.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen pictures of him? He looks like a super creep.
Like I said, he looks like a late-year Beatle.
But worse.
That's my story. And again, I apologize if some of the pronunciations probably weren't correct.
All of our Russian listeners, you should at us about it. Tell us about how bad our Russian is, which is 100% bad.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Rasputin, that's cool. I'm going to get into my story now, and to tie into your story, you know that you're the goat of a thing when people start referring to you as the your name of another thing. So now that we've learned all about Rasputin, the goat of unkillable dudes, let's learn about Michael Malloy, who became known as the Rasputin of the Bronx.
Okay.
Michael Malloy was a real person who lived in New York, but his story almost sounds like a legend with embellishments that have been added in every retelling. You know, like a whisper down the lane, broken telephone situation. And as I did research on this story, I did find that some of the minor details differed from source to source, but the main points of the story were the same. So yeah. I'm going to try to tell it as best I can.
I find that most things that we look at, there's always slight differences in different opinion, but like I said, enough of it rhymes that you can get the basic framework.
Right. Here's the core of the story. Picture it. New York City, 1933. It's a particularly shitty point in history, as we are just a few years into the Great Depression and several years into Prohibition in the United States.
Yeah. And I tell you, we're killing it with the references tonight. There's a Golden Girls reference.
That's right. You know the Golden Girls? I don't think they were a lot older than what I am right now.
Yeah. Like, there was a, I saw a thing like on the internet somewhere. It was talking about the Golden Girls in the 80s. These were like 50-year-old women. Then they showed like the new Sex and the City show, and they're all the same age.
Well, yeah, you look at Dorothy Zbornak versus Jennifer Lopez, right?
Right.
What the fuck? What happened?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we're in the Great Depression and Prohibition in the United States. So the Great Depression, that's when there was a huge stock crash. It led to massive unemployment and general misery. And Prohibition was when American government made alcohol illegal after years of pressure from a variety of holier-than-thou lobbyists. I can only imagine that founding father and beer and wine enthusiast Benjamin Franklin was rolling in his grave in Philadelphia at the ratification of this amendment. While droves of people continued to suffer from unemployment, there was no shortage of alcohol as long as you knew where to go to get it.
Moe's Pet Store.
Exactly.
What pet store is open 2 a.m? The best damn pet store in town.
There you go, Simpsons. I don't have a wrestling reference this week, so you're going to have to work one in here somewhere.
Let me see what I can do.
Okay. Across the country, illegal drinking establishments known as speakeasies were everywhere, including one at 3804 3rd Avenue in the Bronx borough of New York City, which was owned and operated by a man named Tony Marino. One day in January of 1933, Marino was chatting with his bartender, Joseph Murphy, and his patrons slash associates, Frank Pasqua and Dan Kreisberg, about the desperate state of things. If only, the men thought, there was a way to get a little money to get ahead of the game. And then one of them spotted the main character of our story, Michael Malloy, in the corner of the room, drunk as usual, and a devious plan was hatched. Aside from being an Irishman, a hopeless alcoholic, an unemployed homeless person, and one who had no friends or family, the group didn't know much about Malloy. Actually, in hindsight, this seems to mean that they knew quite a lot about this stranger.
I was going to say, that's a pretty good biography there.
Yeah, but that's how the story goes. The men figured that judging by the amount of alcohol Malloy consumed daily, he was not long for this world. So what harm would it be if they were to take out life insurance on him and simply cash in? And that's quite a way to think about a human being.
Sorry, dollar signs, baby.
Yeah, this wasn't a very ethical crowd. Now, this is where there's deviations in the plot. And at this point, they either got someone to pose as Michael Malloy's brother to take out the policies, or they tricked Malloy into signing the paperwork, telling him that it was a petition to have Marino run for public office, or they tricked him into signing the policies by telling him that it was a contract for free booze for life. So one way or the other, they were able to take out at least 2 life insurance policies for a total of about $3,500, which is about $75,000 in today's money.
Okay.
All they needed to do now was wait for Malloy to inevitably die from alcohol poisoning. But it wasn't that easy. It seemed that Michael Malloy had a superhuman tolerance for alcohol, so the gang, who were later dubbed the Murder Trust in the media, thought that they'd help speed things along by allowing Malloy to have unlimited free drinks at Marino's speakeasy. They even set up a mattress in the back for him to crash, and presumably so they wouldn't need to go too far to find the body. They witnessed Malloy drink and drink an unbelievable amount, but no matter what, he always returned the next day ready for more.
It's like Andre the Giant.
Yes.
Go. There it is. He had the Guinness Book of Record for the most, I think he drank 139 beers in one sitting or something like that. I'm not sure on the number, but he did at one point have the Guinness Book of Records for drinking the most alcoholic drinks in one sitting.
Now, as much as I love having wrestling references in every episode, I might have to cut that out because in the very beginning we said there was no Guinness Book of World Record talk here.
Oh.
Okay, so they figured they would give him as much alcohol as he wanted. So instead of limiting him, they were just like, have as much as you want. You're our big friend and buddy now. Hoping that it would spur him along to die of alcohol poisoning, basically. Yeah. But this was starting to get really expensive to supply all this illegal booze. So again, they needed to think of a way to move this plan along. So they figured wood alcohol would do the trick. This was a pretty common and potentially deadly practice when normal consumable alcohol was hard to come by. But still, this had no effect. Molloy was after drinking more than enough wood alcohol to kill any normal man, but he seemed just to smile and ask for more. The fleet of skeets upped the ante again. Next, they got a bunch of old rotten oysters and soaked them in wood alcohol for good measure. They offered this snack as an accompaniment to his limitless drink.
To drink wood alcohol, you really got to be desperate. I like a beer as much as anybody, but I can do without it before having to drink wood alcohol.
Yes, I would say that most people could do without it. But I mean, obviously this guy had a problem, right?
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
He was a suffering soul, and these people were taking advantage of him. But surely there was no way that he could survive old rotten oysters soaked in wood alcohol. Yet, here he was, back again, looking for more.
Have you ever had oysters?
No, I've never eaten oysters.
You're right. They look too slimy for me.
It's not something that I care to eat.
I'm not a big seafood person anyway. People, when they hear I'm from Newfoundland and I say that, they kind of freak out. But
I know. But same. I'm not a seafood person. That seems like a gross thing to eat. So at this point, they're after giving them all the consumable alcohol and wood alcohol that they can get their hands on. So they figured that this character could really withstand any kind of alcohol. So they'd have to turn to yet another tactic. They procured some expired sardines and whipped up a fine scoff of spoiled sardine sandwiches garnished with carpet tacks and ground up tin.
Jeez.
I know. How they planned on explaining just how their dearly departed managed to consume such non-food items is anyone's guess. But I can only assume that they were getting fairly annoyed and desperate.
Would that kill you, though?
Well, that's what they were trying to do.
It wouldn't taste good, but I don't think it'd kill you.
Carpet tacks and ground up tin.
What's carpet tacks?
Carpet tacks are nails that you've nailed carpet down with.
Oh, okay. I thought it was kind of, I don't know what it was. Okay.
Basically nails, ground up tin. You can't eat metal. You're not a goat.
I suppose, yeah.
Anyway, much to their chagrin, Molloy was back again the next day inquiring if there were any more of those delicious sammies on hand. Okie dokie. Clearly this guy has guts of a billy goat. So nothing that he'd eat or drink was going to accomplish their wicked goal. They decided that maybe Molloy might be another victim of the harsh cold winter. So one night they got him drunk, as per usual. Then they walked him to a park, stripped off his clothes, doused him in water, and left him there for the elements. Now they've gone way beyond letting him meet his own demise by way of his own accordance of drinking too much. They're actively trying to murder him.
You're probably going to break even on this deal when it's all said and done.
That comes in at the end of the story.
Okay.
This time for sure, the unkillable Michael Molloy would not be able to survive the night. Yet, he did. From the point of view of the conspirators, he had the unmitigated gall to show up the next day in fresh new clothes with a brand new thirst. It's speculated that he was discovered in the park and taken in for the night by some charitable organization, given new clothes, given a warm place to sleep, and sent on his way the next day. Now it was time for the crowd to get serious. A car accident would do it, they thought. So the gang recruited a taxi driver named Harry Green to run over Molloy with his cab. They got Molloy plastered again, took him out to a designated site, propped him up in the middle of the road, and Green struck him full force with the car.
I mean, laugh.
It's a crazy story. The next day, Molloy did not show up to the speakeasy. Nor the next day or the day after that. The murder trust assumed that they were finally successful, but to claim the life insurance, they needed to get the body. So they called around to all the hospitals and all the morgues, and none of them had a body of Michael Molloy. At this point, they're wondering, did we go through all that just to lose the body and the life insurance? They contemplated killing another random person and claiming that that was Molloy. But before that happened, and 3 weeks after he was run over by Harry Green's cab, Michael Molloy waltzed into Tony Marino's speakeasy, apologizing for his absence and requesting a nice, refreshing drink. It seems, he explained, that he'd woken up in a hospital with a concussion, a broken shoulder, and no recollection of what had happened.
Well, that's good. At least they're still anonymous about about the murder plot.
It's crazy. This is the last straw now. Finally, the gang got Malloy drunk again, brought him to one of their apartments, connected a rubber hose from a gas line, and put it directly into Malloy's mouth until he succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning. This is how they actually killed him.
Why didn't they just, like, shoot him or throw him in a river or something?
Their plan was despicable to begin with, but they didn't plan on actively trying to hurt him. They were just like, he's going to die. Like,
he's going to take care of himself.
He's going to drink himself to death.
And we'll be there for the profit.
Exactly. By the end of it, they kidnapped him, held him down, and put a hose in his mouth. Like, you fucker, you're going to die now. They bribed a doctor to say that his cause of death was pneumonia, produced his body, buried him, and collected on the insurance. By the time their plan to murder Michael Malloy was complete, they spent about $2,000, leaving them with just $1,500 to split among them. And as you can tell by the story, Marino and the rest of the murder trust were degenerates. Eventually, they started to brag about their great feat, and word spread about Iron Michael Malloy, the Rasputin of the Bronx. This eventually caught the ear of one of the insurance companies who paid out the policy, and it smelled as bad as a tray of poisoned oysters to him. An investigation ensued. Malloy's body was disinterred, and an autopsy was performed by a non-bribed doctor. It was clear to him that Malloy was the victim of carbon monoxide poisoning, and due to all the talk and suspicion, the police eventually arrested and charged Tony Marino, Joseph Murphy, Frank Pasqua, Dan Kreisberg, and the cab driver, Harry Green, with the murder of Michael Malloy. Green received a prison sentence. The doctor who lied on the original death certificate was charged as an accessory after the fact, and Marino, Murphy, Pasqua, and Kreisberg were sentenced to death. They each died by electric chair at Sing Sing Prison, and as far as I know, their deaths only took one attempt each.
You got the chair?
Oh, yes.
For the sake of 1/8 of a cut of $1,500, or whatever it was.
They split it between, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. Four of them split it, and then they cut the cab driver in for a bit. They cut the doctor in for a bit, but that was all part of their expenses, that 2,000 expenses.
Oh, okay.
So the four of them split $1,500.
Jeez. It's like a supervillain's elaborate plan to kill somebody. Why don't you just do it?
I know.
Drinking yourself to death is one thing, but like you said, sticking a hose at her throat.
Once they went from anxious observer to active participant.
Yeah, exactly. Premeditated murder at that point, yeah.
Yeah, if he had died from drinking himself to death and they collected on the insurance, they probably wouldn't have had any suspicion cast upon them.
That's right. I'm going bankrupt trying to kill the man.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Crime doesn't pay.
That's the proof right there. There you have it. Weird stories about some resilient people.
What do you think about these stories? You could share your ideas with us at someweirdpodcast@gmail.com.
Or on the Twitter or Instagram machines at somewordpod.
Or at our website, somewordpodcast.com.
If you haven't done so already, please follow or subscribe wherever you listen so you'll never miss an episode.
And if you've enjoyed this episode and you want to help us out, please leave a 5-star review wherever you listen so others can discover us. And don't be afraid to tell a friend about the Some Weird Podcast.
These stories are somewhere by...
Something Weird.
Do you remember the robot could put his arm back on?
Oh, yeah.
Jumping through the fucking blades.
They can cut you. These are the mean machines.
Planet Cut or whatever it was. Planet Machine.
I don't know what it was. But it looked awesome. He's swinging around all those pipes and steam coming out everywhere.
Yeah. I'm Astar the robot. I can put my arm back on.
Astar?
Astar. Asturd. I think it was Astar, wasn't it?
Asturd.
I think it was Astar, though.
I don't know.
Isn't that what's her name? Jan's kid's name in the office? Astrid?
Astrid.
Astrid.
Astrid.